Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Alan Auerbach, Professor of Economics and Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and your moderator for this evening's program. I'm delighted to introduce my friend and colleague in the field of economics, Dr. Edmund Phelps. He was the 2006 Nobel Laureate in Economics and is the author of many books, including a new one called Mass Flourishing: How Grassroots Innovation Created Jobs, Challenge, and Change. This book examines modern economics and what makes nations prosper, and why the sources of that prosperity are under threat today. Ned Phelps teaches economics and is the director of the Center on Capitalism and Society at Columbia University. He has long studied the sources of economic growth and the causes of unemployment. On announcing his Nobel Prize, the prize committee specifically cited his path-breaking work on key trade-offs in economics between inflation and unemployment, and on the well-being of current versus future generations. He's also known for the breadth of his approach to economics, drawing, as he does in this book, on important contributions from philosophy, literature, and the arts. And I must say that few other economists could comfortably cite Aristotle and Lady Gaga in the same chapter. Dr. Phelps was born near Chicago, grew up in suburban New York, and later studied at Amherst and Yale. And he's the recipient, in addition to the Nobel Prize, of many international awards and honorary degrees. Please welcome our guest.
Thank you very much, Professor Auerbach. It's a pleasure to be here to speak to you about my book, Mass Flourishing. The book is about the modern economies, as I call them, that arose in a few nations in the 19th century. Britain and America around 1820, later Germany and France. Economies that remained well-functioning to the middle of the 20th century. They were the marvel of the world. The wonder was not so much the high wages and wealth. There was rampant prosperity, material and non-material. Mark Twain spoke of the drive and push and rush and struggle of the raging, tearing, booming 19th century. One kind of prosperity was classical. Modern economies were achieving growth of economic knowledge, thus growth of productivity. Hence, wage rates and working conditions were constantly improving throughout the economy. A worker could just ride the rising tide. And non-modern economies, through trade and technological transfers, could tap into that prosperity in order to catch up. Another kind of prosperity was modern and of key importance. There were gains in one's earning power from one's new insights and skills, and gains in one's satisfaction from new experiences in one's work. These gains, material and non-material, are rewards of initiating and creating. They represent succeeding, or the term I will use, prospering. Non-modern nations could not tap into that prospering. Never before had prospering been within reach of large and increasing numbers. Before the first modern economies, economic knowledge, thus productivity, was virtually stagnant, even in the economies that were the jewels of mercantile capitalism, such as Spain and Holland. The concept of job satisfaction was unknown. For me, the lone shepherd, bored by the routine and isolated, symbolizes that system. The new mass prospering was brought by mass innovating, though the historians spoke only of resources, efficiencies, and increasing returns to scale. In the stream of new methods and products, Some found adoption by consumers or producers, changing the complexion of the economy. In Britain and America especially, there was a welter of innovations, large and small, not just headline innovations. In an 1858 lecture, Abraham Lincoln said of America that there was a perfect rage for the new, a rage that was rife among makers of products, I would judge, as well as users, which Lincoln was mostly talking about. Where did ideas for innovation come from? The German historical school and the young Austrian Joseph Schumpeter believe that innovations originated from a succession of discoveries by scientists and engineers who were generally exogenous to the economy, and the commercial applications of these discoveries by entrepreneurs. But the modern economies possess their own dynamism, the desire, capacity, and scope to innovate. This led to an outpouring of imagining, tinkering, testing, and trying out. These economies were capable of indigenous innovation, not just the exogenous innovation of the German historical school. The system of dynamism was more effective the more open it was to contributors down to the grassroots. And the modern economies were rather open to the grassroots. Human resources of initiative and imagination were being devoted to innovating, not just producing and trading. Dynamism ran high to the middle of the 20th century. No wonder there was mass prosperity. No economy before drew on the imagination of such a wide range of the nation's minds. This dynamism required entrepreneurs and financiers, of course, just as the sporadic innovations of an exogenous sort in the mercantile period did. Their judgment and expertise was needed. Yet dynamism further required innovators, innovators with the insight, imaginativeness, and vision to dream up new products that might pan out and win adoption. Yet the idea that business activity in a free market can always be depended upon to possess the dynamism for indigenous innovation is a mistake. The right stuff is required. Innovators often have to buck conventional thinking or to break away from traditional ties to family and friends. Innovating also requires a social and political climate that is receptive to innovations despite the disruptions they are apt to cause. Was the modern economy desirable? Modern economies yielded a sustained rise of material benefits, including rising productivity and wages, decreasing disease, decreasing poverty and pauperism, and increasing inclusion. In the worst factories, workers had at least escaped the farm. The more radical impact of the new economies was non-material. They changed the very nature of life and work where they took root. There were experiential rewards from working on new problems, gathering insights, imagining and creating novel things, testing them in the workplace, and trying them out in the marketplace. And there were existential rewards of self-discovery and personal growth from journeying into the unknown. The adventurous and exploratory spirit of the modern economies emerging in the 20th century cities was reflected in also in the arts of the period. Of course, this transformation depended on the development of institutions that enabled dynamism, including various legal rights, laws governing corporations and financial institutions. The real crux, though, and one not given enough weight until now, is the rise of modern values, the spread of modern attitudes, precepts, and beliefs. These modern values can be roughly grouped under the headings of individualism, thinking for oneself, working for oneself, willing to break from one's group and from convention. Vitalism, relishing challenges, overcoming obstacles, satisfying curiosity, competing, taking the initiative, acting on the world. And finally, self-expression, imagining and creating, demonstrating an insight by testing it, voyaging into the unknown in hopes of making a mark. A basic thesis of the book is that the slow accretion of these modern values finally achieved the critical mass necessary to whet the desire in individuals to innovate, to spur the capabilities required to innovate, and boost the willingness of society to give wide scope for innovation. The book documents the modern values from the onset of the modern era to its winding down, roughly from 1490 to about 1940. Individualism began with the humanism of the late Renaissance, vitalism with the quests of the Baroque era, and the curiosity of the Enlightenment, and self-expression with the Romantic period. This cultural heritage belonged to the world, certainly to all of the Western nations. But it is implicit in the book that some of the nations did not fully assimilate it into their life, into the values they act on. Ultimately, severe reactions to the modern economies set in some countries. The fluctuations and disparities in incomes, and even in prospects, typical of modern economies, and the endemic unemployment led to socialist opposition. Some nations moved part of the way to a socialist economy, seeing more planning and more state ownership as a step towards stability, equality, and greater employment. Generally speaking, the socialists spoke of greater development of people's capacities to produce, but showed no consideration or awareness of the deeper goals of individuals, the non-material rewards deriving from a life of self-expression, such as exploration and creativity. The socialists neglected to provide for innovation. The rudderlessness and the social upheaval wrought by the modern economies led in the 1920s and 30s, the so-called interwar years, to a corporatist reaction, invoking some traditional values found as far back as the Middle Ages and even in mercantile capitalism. The corporatist critique in Italy, Germany, and France drew upon a set of traditional values. Corporatists hated new enterprises invading towns and hated new money upsetting traditional ways, wealth, and status. So they hated the lack of society's control over the modern economy. The essence of their thought, I believe, was a revolt against individualism and self-expression. For them, what mattered was the good of the nation, not the individual, and the government got to decide what is good for the nation. The classic corporatist economy retained private ownership, but left little control to the owners. It replaced competition and the market with a tripartite system of business confederations, labor unions, both with little power, and the state. Corporatist institutions and policies aimed at social protection and solidarity. These economies were conspicuous for their patronage and lobbying, not to mention cronyism and nepotism. Mussolini, a leading corporatist, promised higher productivity through innovation without actually arranging for it. Corporatists and socialists have continued to this day to claim that their systems boost economic performance, at least on their measures of good performance. But data from the 1980s and 1990s do not support those claims. In brief, the more socialist economies do not excel at employment, did not in the 80s and 90s. The more corporatist economies did not excel at growth. Those economies have proved so woefully lacking in innovation, indigenous or even exogenous, that they have been unable to realize their own goals. My book tests its thesis that highly prospering nations require high dynamism, and for that they have to be high in modern values. To simplify the investigation, the book tests whether to be highly prospering, nations have to be high in modern values. That is done by using the prevalence of several attitudes reported in household surveys, a preference for jobs that are interesting, that involve initiative, that offer change and present challenges, such as competition, to represent the prevalence of modern values, and using the prevalence of reported job satisfaction as a measure of the prevalence of prospering. Among 18 countries in the OECD, the six countries where job satisfaction was widespread were all above average in modern values. The more prevalent modern values are, the more prevalent the job satisfaction is. And by the way, the same thing is true of life satisfaction. Also, the countries where traditional values are more prevalent tend to report very low job satisfaction. To return to the book's narrative, in the post-war years, Germany and France enjoyed rapid growth again, and Italy found new growth. But it was mostly through technological transfers. There was mounting evidence of lessened dynamism. In Britain and Germany, later France, the loss of indigenous innovation appears to have been considerable, though concealed by continuing technology transfers from America as long as the supply lasted, which was about the late 1990s. In America, the growth rate of productivity, net of the part attributable to the growth of capital per worker, that fell in the early 1970s, rather abruptly, to about one-half of what it had been consistently in the period 1922 to 1972. And it remained there ever since, with the exception of the years of the internet build-out in 1996 to 2004. What has happened is that innovation has narrowed, diminishing in most established industries, rising in some. Predictably, the declines of innovation were followed by a major ballooning of unemployment in all four of the nations under discussion. What are the root causes of all that? The book lays much of these declines, not all, these declines of dynamism, to a rise of traditional and anti-modern or anti-business values since pre-war times, when dynamism was still strong. Let me talk about America. There has been a spread of the much-discussed money culture. Fewer people prefer years of austerity trying to innovate with a doubtful pecuniary payoff, only the non-material reward, to working in jobs that pay very well. In many people, the desire to make money has grown into what is usually called greed. A survey of financial people found that about half of the respondents said they would engage in insider trading if there was no risk of being caught. This widespread desperation for money must lead to a lot of self-dealing by managers in large firms, mutual funds, and banks. Pathologies that must divert managers from innovation to short-termism. In America, at least, there is a much commented rise of an adolescent culture, low on concentration and self-discipline. Relatedly, a striking devaluation of achievement. Witness the denigration of creative figures. Tighter traditional values tie many a young person to their family's circle of friends or communities. Few say anymore, "Go west, young man, go west." A new culture of entitlement brings pressure on companies to allow employees to meet family needs by working at home, which makes innovation a little bit more difficult. A key precept of the new corporatism, the right to social protection from the market, has led to pervasive patronage from politicians to the public and campaign contributions from corporations and labor unions to the politicians. When established corporations are protected through special interest legislation, such as the evergreening of old patents, they become less interested in innovation than in rent seeking. And after the corporations have got their carve-outs and their special interest tax deductions, outsiders with potentially innovative ideas are unable to enter. They cannot innovate. And the insiders can drop their defensive innovation. They don't need to innovate anymore because they're no longer under threat of entry. The nexus between private and public in education, medical care, and pharmaceuticals is impeding innovation in those industries. Another precept of the new corporatism, the state, the idea that the state is needed to set important directions for the economy, leads to elites in government playing a larger role in the nation's attempts at innovating, and the ordinary people doing grassroots innovation a smaller role. And it is the latter people, the people doing grassroots innovation, who have the advantage of being upfront and having a sense of where to go. Yet another of the new corporatist precepts, all must move in lockstep, invites the government to place its efforts on aiding laggard companies, thus diluting or removing companies' incentives to try to pull themselves up and to avoid falling behind to begin with. Thus, America has strayed pretty far from the pioneer spirit captured by Willa Cather and the movie Shane. And the new values have choked off much of the modern economy's dynamism, not just caused a loss of efficiency, which was the focus of Mansur Olson or much earlier Jean-Baptiste Say. The conclusion from this is clear. Modern values, if they are predominant, spark the engine of human imagination that drive innovation that is central to the modern economy. In contrast, some traditional or anti-modern values directly inhibit attempts to innovate, and some traditional values, if they prevail over modern values, foster elements of a corporatist economy that impede or even block innovation. Well, what sort of an economy ought we to aim for now? What is the good and the just? Some serious people have suggested that we should say goodbye to growth. Well, the book agrees that it is especially the non-material rewards that were the great gift to nations with modern economies. But now prominent economists and commentators are proposing to say goodbye to dynamism and prospering. They are advocating a focus on the quality of life, amenities like sports stadiums, comforts like clean streets, and securities. A well-known report from the OECD views wealth and leisure as the highest goods. My book argues that an economy, to be a good economy, must be structured to offer participants prospects of the good life. It would be an injustice to deprive people of prospects of the good life. Further, the book sees the good life as the conception developed across centuries in the modern era by a succession of philosophers and humanists. A life of exploration, creativity, and discovery. The modern conception, this modern conception derives from Pico, Luther, Montaigne, Cervantes, Shakespeare, Hume, Hegel, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, William James, and Bergson. Philosophers use the word flourishing to characterize this sort of life. It is apparent that the prospering that came to the modern economies is a splendid example of the philosopher's flourishing. Moreover, ordinary people have no other source of this flourishing. Where are they going to go except to embrace the challenges and opportunities of the business world? So the modern economies were offering the good life to a large number of participants all the way to the grassroots. An economy both good and just must be geared to those with the poorest prospects of a good life. With the poorest prospects of a good life, the greatest prospects possible. And if some people are not oriented toward the conception of the good life, a just society will allow them to operate their own sorts of economies. This breaks, I guess, with accepted thought. Both the left and the right and the corporatists overlook the world of creation with its imagining and venturing, and the resulting personal growth in favor of materialist criteria, such as leisure and wealth. But their quality life is no substitute for the good life. The good life is a wild ride through an economy with an open future, an economy offering unimagined rewards, a life of Kierkegaardian mystery, Nietzschean challenge, and Bergsonian becoming. That, I submit, is what we must hope to regain. Let me just make one tiny suggestion. I would say that it will be necessary to broaden to the whole economy the spirit of grassroots innovation that arose especially in California, in garages, the music business, the film industry, and in several sparkling companies. The nation must aim for a more participatory economy, for a sort of grassroots revolution. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest is Edmund Phelps, Nobel Prize-winning economist and author of a new book called Mass Flourishing: How Grassroots Innovation Created Jobs, Challenge, and Change. I'm Alan Auerbach, your moderator for this evening's program. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online at Fora TV. Let me, as we wait for questions to come from the audience, let me ask a couple of myself that were prompted both by reading your book and also by listening to you. To pick up on something you touched on at the very end of your talk, for many of us who live near San Francisco and Silicon Valley, it's hard to believe that American innovation has slowed down. It certainly isn't evident from life around here. And you were suggesting that what's been happening in California has to spread. And I wonder if you can tell us what lessons from the innovation we are experiencing in the Bay Area and California more generally, what lessons we can learn for the rest of the country.
Right. Well, for one thing, most of these operations that have been so successful in California were young and small, and though they grew rapidly and became big, moderately big in a short time. Well, in the heartland, it seems to me that you haven't seen all those startups. You haven't seen all those garage innovators. It's the heartland seems to be more under a blanket or under the control of big established corporations, and as I was saying in my talk, Those big established corporations have had the political power to elicit from the government a lot of protection, which has made it harder for startups to enter the industry there and give the big established companies some competition. So maybe there's nothing in the water in California that explains it. Maybe California is just the place where it's nice, sunny, warm, and so why not start there rather than somewhere else? But it's clear that there is a terrific gung-ho spirit in so many of the enterprises in California. And of course, Steve Jobs is the patron saint of all that.
One of the issues I was thinking about as I was reading your book, and it was prompted again by your comments when you were indicating that one of the problems of corporatism is the protection of failing enterprises. And you also, in your book, talk more generally about the social safety net and a dulling of incentives. On the other hand, you also acknowledge the increasing inequality in the U.S. And I'm wondering how you square on the one hand, you suggest there's, you indicate concern about the scope of the social safety net, which I guess applies to individuals as well as to companies. And you indicate that taxes on entrepreneurial activity may stifle innovation. So how do you deal with increasing inequality while still promoting innovation?
Well, I suppose with two or more instruments, we can aim at both targets. I think we can do things to open up the economy to startups, give aid and encouragement to startups, while with other instruments, let's say fiscal instruments, we could address increases in inequality. From time immemorial, I think governments have used different instruments for different goals. So one part of the government is promoting A at the expense of B, and another part of the government is promoting B at the expense of A. But under certain conditions, it works out okay, and there's a net increase in both A and B. We don't require every organ of government to be aiming for the same thing. So I'm afraid that's a rather abstract answer to your question.
Fine. I know. I mean, it's a difficult problem. One problem you see when you were talking about the money culture and the behavior of managers and financiers, a problem you see is in the behavior of managers is short-sightedness, not just in the business executives themselves, but also investment managers, the mutual funds that are investing in companies. You characterize them by looking for quick profits rather than for longer-term payoffs that would result from important innovations. Mm-hmm. How would you address this problem? Are there government policies? It seems to be some sort of a cultural shift, but is there something the government could do to arrest it?
I don't know, Alan. I don't have much expertise in the financial area. But I feel pretty sure that if a bunch of experts were to sit down, they could make some changes in corporate governance,
give a bigger voice for share owners who might be quite interested in the future health of the company more than the health next quarter. And there surely there are lots of things that could be done to restructure mutual funds. And of course, I do think that the entire financial sector has to be taken a hard look at the entire financial sector, because somehow in all the toing and the to and fro, there's not much lending to small businesses anymore, to startups. I mean, there was a time when I think, I don't want to romanticize it too much, but when small banks were not just lending for home purchases, they were also lending a new young company in the town. Now I think the new young company is not getting any support at all from the financial sector. It's only the rich uncle, the angel investor, that might step in.
That brings me to a related question about the financial sector. When you were talking about corporatism, one of the concerns you have is the increasing involvement of government in the U.S. economy as an impediment to innovation and mass flourishing. But if we think about our very recent, very costly recession, many people attribute that in large part to excessive deregulation, particularly of in financial markets. So how do we determine the right balance? How do we determine the proper role for government in the economy, particularly in areas like the financial sector, where on the one hand we see problems such as the lack of capital for smaller businesses, but we also see excesses. And there's certainly been a move toward increasing regulation in this area in the last few years. Is that consistent with your view of what we need for innovation and mass flourishing? How do we do that?
Well, first of all, I tried pretty hard in the book not to appear to be taking the position that any and every cutback in government expenditure is desirable. I never thought that. What I'm arguing against is this kind of insidious nexus or link between special interest groups and politicians, with all the politicians knocking themselves out to think of ways to help special constituencies in return for campaign support. it's the character of the spending that I think is so disastrous, because it creates a climate in which the business managers are led to think more about how to get a better deal from out of Washington, how to get a carve out or get some special interest tax deduction out of Washington, which takes a lot of time and thought, but then that comes out of the time and thought that might have been given to innovation. It just poisons the whole business atmosphere, it seems to me. So it's that I want to see dealt with. And elsewhere in the book, I certainly put in a good word for low-wage employment subsidies in order to get more disadvantaged people into the business sector so that they have some experience of the business sector so they can contribute as potentially innovative people, and also so that they are better role models for their children, so their children have some role models of that would help them to see what business is and what there might be in business for them. So, and I've even suggested in some work with Leo Tillman that the federal government might want to start up sort of a first national bank for innovation that would go out and the bank would go out and borrow, would issue government-backed bonds paying very low interest, and the bank, with its many branches, would lend to startup companies to help them get on with their attempts to bring their innovative product to market. That was that idea is based on the farm credit system. So we already have in the federal government a bank like that to help farmers with decisions about seeds and fertilizers and all that. So why don't we carry out the same idea with innovation? So I'm not an anti-government guy. I'm not even arguing for a net decrease of spending, but I am certainly arguing for a contraction of all this corporatist spending, which has such an insidious effect upon the economic spirit.
Speaking about areas of government spending where you might see benefits, you talk in the book about the role of education as important in promoting creativity and innovation. You also suggest that today's students lack the attention span to study the classics. So how should we reform our educational system so that on the one hand it provides the perspective that students need to innovate while also ensuring that they have the basic skills required in today's economy?
Well, I can't answer all of that, and you wouldn't want to listen to me if I could, but I've been saying with a little twinkle in the eye, I guess, that I'd love to see the classics brought back to high school education and maybe middle year schooling as well. When I was growing up, I had to read. I read a lot of adventure stories, and in high school, we certainly read Shakespeare and other works of the imagination. And I think these are disappearing from curriculums in public schools in this country. And somebody told me that Julius Caesar cannot be made required reading by the New York State Regents because they found that many students cannot get through it, though it's not a particularly long or difficult play. And so I think the government's going to have to do. I know there are all sorts of constitutional issues about federal government and education, but I think the federal government's really going to have to spend a lot more and use some added spending to address the problem of renewing the sense of adventure and exploration and discovery in the schooling process.
Well, it's now time for our audience question period, and we've been accumulating a number of questions, so let me begin. There are a couple of questions here dealing with demography, asking what role demography plays in the dynamism you envision. Another question refers to the vast number of immigrants we have, the continuing flow of people into our workforce, our educational system, and I guess both of these questions are raising the issue of what role our changing demography internally as well as our immigration can play in achieving dynamism.
When I think of demography, I think of the wave of workers who are now retiring, having reached what we call the retirement age. That they're reaching that in large numbers now, and this will go on and intensify up until about 2020. So we're losing old folks such as myself from the economy. Does that have any consequences for dynamism and the rate of innovation? I suppose that when you lose any large number of people, you there's some loss there, and we don't need to debate whether that loss is bigger if old people leave the labor force than if young people leave the labor force. Perhaps there's some age at which a person is most valuable and would be most costly to lose, but it's not age 21 and it's not age 80, somewhere in between. I don't think that the slowdown of innovation that I mentioned in my talk was a result of of anything demographic going on in the 1970s. That was way before the exodus from the labor force of recent years. Flow of immigrants. I don't think there's any doubt that immigrants have been a powerful force for immigration in this country from the beginning. Of course, at some point everybody in the country was an immigrant. So yeah, I think it would be good for immigration good for innovation if a lot of the technical people who could grease the wheels of the innovation process were allowed to come in. And at the same time, and additionally, I would say that one of the things about immigrants is that they usually arrive with not a lot of wealth in hand. So they're very motivated. While people who have been here for generations have a lot of wealth. And people with a lot of wealth maybe don't want to, maybe they just want to sit back and enjoy it rather than take the big chances of attempting innovation.
So here's a question to put you on the spot. Is there any national organization or politician that you view as a strong proponent of dynamism and staunchly in opposition to corporatism and socialism?
Gosh. What an interesting question. I can't think of one. And if I'm right that it's hard to think of one, there's got to be a lesson in that. It just shows how endemic this thing is. I know that some of you might think of the Tea Party as being a kind of opposition force, but it seems to me that the Tea Party people are not talking about corporatism, at least not in any explicit terms. And they're certainly not proposing creative new government programs to get dynamism going again. They simply want to cut back spending in order to cut back tax rates. So I don't think providing any ammunition for my position.
Here's one about labor force. Do you believe American workers today have less of a work ethic than they did in the past? Most indicators suggest that we're working harder and longer than our parents.
Well, I find that's a hard, complicated question. I do think that there's this money culture, this just doing it for the money, which tends to crowd out doing things for the excitement of it. I do think that's very bad, and I think that probably infects the labor force across the board, from ordinary workers to management. I'm surprised that I didn't. I guess it is true that I don't know. Is it true that the work week is lengthened?
Well, I think you'd probably want to not talk about the last few years, given the seriousness of the recession. I think prior to that, it was not. But it was true that the U.S. work week is longer than the work weeks in most other countries.
That's true.
So that if
I don't think that tells us very much about what may have happened to attitudes towards innovation. People might be working long hours in law firms and hospitals, and I think we have increasing a higher proportion of the labor force in those long workday, work week industries. So maybe that's what we're looking at.
So here's a question that relates again to the issue of the income distribution. It seems like a lot of the jobs that we're creating are low-wage service jobs, the kind of jobs that probably you would suggest don't yield the same kind of job satisfaction and challenges that you see as part of a dynamic economy. Where are those good jobs going to come from?
The good ones?
Yeah.
How are we going to get good ones? Well, we got to crank up the innovation again. and crank up the dynamism that underlies it. And I think, you know, I said a few things in my talk about that. Sort of, maybe we could somehow imitate California in many ways. But I think, you know, we've just got to have a national conversation about what we want our economy to do, and which, of course, will depend upon what sort of lives, what sort of working lives we want to lead. And that will lead then, of course, to a national conversation about what we want the government to do. Even if some clever little thing popped into my head, which it hasn't done, I'd still feel kind of silly mentioning it, because what we need to do is 100 different things, I think, and no one or two or three or 10 things is going to turn it around in a big way.
On the issue of what the government can do, in particular, dealing with corporatism, which you've described as one of the problems we have, is there a role for antitrust policy? Should we have a shift in our pursuit of antitrust measures? Should the Justice Department be more aggressive? Is there a particular focus they should take?
Gee, I would certainly think so. I'm not an industrial org economist, so I yield to them on this question. But it seems to me that we have some whopping big corporations out there with a lot of oligopolistic power, and as I mentioned in my talk, the corporations have all sorts of weapons that the Congress has given them to give them advantages over new entrants and scare off new entrants. And so one of the things that we might well do is break up some of those big corporations. It would be a kind of a, for each corporation, for each piece of an old corporation, it would be like a new day with new opportunities, new thinking required, new thinking invited. It'd be like instant startups. If you took a big corporation and chopped it up into 10 pieces, you'd have right away 10 startups with all the flexibility kind of a sense of a new chance.
Here's a question about a big problem and how increasing innovation might help. How do we increase support for the kind of innovation needed to solve some things like global warming? Is this the kind of thing that would come about naturally as a result of greater dynamism? Is there a special role for government policy in this area?
Well, I think the American innovation, especially when it was strong, and it was very strong up until 1940 and pretty strong up until the early 1960s, that innovation, you know, created a lot of new techniques, many of which were helpful in dealing with pollution and environmental problems, and certainly that's still the case. There would, I'm sure, be a positive fallout from expanding the rate of innovation in the American economy. And if some new innovations had just the reverse effect, well, we can go jump. The government can go in and tax them in such a way as to make their product more expensive to buyers, so as to keep a lid on that. I'm thinking of fracking. Fracking is a wonderful innovation. It does seem to have the disadvantage that it's letting oil and gas, oil back into the picture, and I thought we didn't want to be using so much oil anymore. But I don't think we should condemn the frackers. I think we should be taking more seriously the idea of taxing things that inflict damage on the environment. It's really a scandal that for political reasons the Congress can't get around to doing that. I seldom say a very good word about Europe, but have to say that Europe has been great about charging very high prices for fuel in order to keep down the consumption.
There's a question here, and I have one of my own relating to this question of international comparisons. You express concern about the recent path of the American economy, although you have very nice things to say about an earlier era. But you also see strengths even now in the American economy that are missing elsewhere. Western Europe, aside from what you were just talking about, China. What nation would you hold up as a model of innovation, and how can the U.S. learn from it?
I don't know. I know people often mention South Korea in general and Samsung in particular, but I don't know whether they have lessons to teach our top companies in those areas. I recognize that there are some innovations coming out of Sweden, a few other places. Denmark is a relatively innovative place. But I don't think that Denmark has any kind of secret that which, if we had it, would help us a whole lot. I just think that Denmark does the sorts of things that our more innovative companies do, maybe the question is pushing me to say something about China. I've been going to China quite a lot in the past 4 years. Became dean of the new Wadu Business School, which turned out to be a rapidly growing thing. When I first started going, I thought, these Chinese, they just copy American technologies. We're just looking at technological transfer. And they have some problems about innovating, because they have some problems about being different or breaking the mold or standing apart and all that. So I assume that their indigenous innovation is zero. Well, boy, was that wrong. Now I think a good estimate of the rate of indigenous innovation in China would be something on the order of 2% per annum. That is to say, their indigenous innovation alone causes the GDP per man hour to be growing at about 2% per annum. And if it's growing at 7%, that's because other stuff is helping along, like transfers from the U.S. And also, the technologies that got installed near the coast are now diffusing to the interior. So you're getting a big boost in growth there, too. So zero is wrong. Maybe 2% is about right. Well, that's actually maybe a little more than what the U.S. is doing right now. I think the rate of growth of output per man hour that has to be attributed to indigenous innovation in the U.S. is more like 1% per annum. So although both 1 and 2 are small numbers, still China is doing twice as well as the U.S. So, but can we learn from the Chinese? I don't know. I imagine we could learn some things from them, just as I'm sure that they could learn plenty of things from the U.S.
Well, we've reached the point in our program where I could only ask you one more brief question, and not to put you on the spot again. How do we accomplish any change in the current political environment?
Since when?
Well, I mean, since right now, we You talk about the problems of deficit spending and other things that we're doing. We don't seem to be accomplishing very much. You already alluded to that. There are a lot of ambitious things that you would have us do in the U.S. A lot of it will start in Washington. How do we get that to happen?
Well, I guess we have to stop doing some of the bad things, so as to make resources available for doing more of the good things. I don't offhand see very many good things we've done. I think we could say two cheers for the Obama Medicare initiative. It was, in many respects, a very good idea to systematize the medical care so that we're not going to have any more the kind of crazy system we had before. On the other hand, it's not at all clear yet that system is going to perform well, and maybe it'll have to go back under surgery again. Otherwise, I don't see much. Haven't seen much of what I would call progress. I haven't seen progress certainly haven't seen progress in dealing with innovation. Instead, what we've seen is a lot of propping up, a lot of social protection, a lot of special favors. I mean, this is predominantly bad. And we've got to stop doing that.
Well, on that sober note, I want to offer our thanks to Dr. Edmund Phelps, Nobel Prize-winning economist, and author of a new book called Mass Flourishing, How Grassroots Innovation Created Jobs, Challenge, and Change. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Alan Auerbach, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.